Hello and welcome to the Home of Medicine podcast with me, Dr. Amy Burbridge. I'm a consultant in acute and general medicine, and I'm joined today by...
Hi, Ben Lovell here, also a consultant in acute and general medicine working in London. Thank you very much for having me back.
Always a pleasure, Ben. So, you've got a case for me.
Yes, this is a case to challenge your self-confessed neurophobia, which we have discussed on podcast. Because the only way you ever get over something is by facing it head on and by making sense of it. So that message engraved upon our hearts. I'm going to tell you about a case of a patient I saw in Esteg recently. And this is a 36-year-old female patient, who woke up that morning with right-sided foot drop. So she'd never had this before. She woke up and went to bed last night with a normal ankle movements and strength and woke up this morning with a weak ankle on the right and felt that she was walking funny. Her foot was dragging a bit, which was noticeable to her and to her flatmates. And she never had this before, obviously. And she came to the A&E department of our hospital, who triaged her round to see us in same-day emergency care in Esteg. And the story was, she was fine when she went to bed last night. She was out last night with some friends, had a few drinks, but was walking fine. Went to bed, woke up this morning, and her right foot was dangling. She said it was sort of just flopping. And she had to elevate her knee, her leg up quite high to clear the ground. Otherwise, her foot would drag. It was a classic foot drop. There was no trauma or injury. I said to her, what do you mean you were out, had a few drinks? Did you fall over or anything like that? No, nothing like that. It wasn't that kind of night. But she did not bash the ankle or wrench or strain. And there wasn't really any pain there. And she didn't have any back pain either. And I asked about sensory loss as well as motor loss. And she said that she did have some altered sensation, although not numbness, but altered sensation over the lateral side of her calf, from the knee down to the ankle. And it extended to the dorsum of her foot, not the sole, the dorsum of her foot. The sole of her foot that she was walking on felt normal. And this patient actually used to be a long time ago, a medical student and a doctor before she changed careers. And she came with a very specific concern. She said, when I was at university, I had a melanoma on my shoulder, which was excised and I was cured. But I'm just terrified because could this be recurrence manifesting as Porter Aquinas syndrome or some kind of spinal cord compression? And that was her concern for me. Do I need an MRI spine? So that's the bare bones of the presentation. Any immediate thoughts that come up for you, Amy?
Panic. my neurophobia is setting in. I can feel my heart rate increasing. I'm starting to go up. It's really strange because it's almost like I've definitely got a bias. I'm just so worried that I'm going to miss something major. And I feel like I never really ever understood neurology. And we've spoken about this before, haven't we? And I feel like I'm too old now to learn it, although it's probably not true either. So we've got a 36-year-old female.
Yes.
Who woke up with a right foot drop, which is indicative of a peroneal nerve palsy on the right side. She had, you describe like a floppy foot, but she got a high steppage gait. You describe she had to lift her foot up high and it was unilateral. So the left foot was completely normal.
Yep.
She also had a decreased sensation on the calf, on the lateral side, but the sole was normal. Did she have any pain?
No, none at all.
Okay. So there's no pain. Was the foot a different colour? So was it pale?
No, it was normal.
Okay, so I'm sort of thinking neurovascular now. You can tell I'm lost, can't you, a little bit? Okay, so the colour was normal. The pulses, were they present?
Yes.
Pulses were present, perfect. Okay, and she'd had no back pain or no injury, although if it was a cord equina, I would expect there maybe to be it affecting the whole leg rather than just an isolated right foot drop, which is quite unusual.
Should I tell you what I had to do?
Go on then.
Google my dermatomes and my myotomes.
Yeah.
And I I say to you in this safe space that I have learned the dermatomes and the myotomes so many times.
Oh, so
Don't
many
say,
times.
will not say, I don't know why. And here's the big confession. I've actually written a medical textbook and I wrote a chapter about neurology examination, about the difference in all the dermatomes. And since I published that book, it's like I shook my head like an etch-a-sketch and deleted all the data. So I do still look, I get the map up, you know, that body map.
Yes, absolutely.
I saw a really interesting post on Twitter, whoops, X, formerly on Twitter, this week, about whether what it feels like for a patient when your doctor starts Googling the consultation. And I thought it was really interesting because, of course, most of the time we're not Googling, we're actually looking up an internal guideline, or maybe we're looking at a micro guide for antibiotics. We're doing stuff on the computer while we're talking to patients because those lovely BNFs that you and I grew up with have gone. And maybe we might be looking at PubMed. Maybe we might be looking at UpToDate or BMJ, something that gives us some latest updates. So we're not usually Googling, but sometimes we do. And I don't know about you, but do you look things up on the computer and show the patient what you're looking up, or is it sort of covert, or maybe you never do this?
I don't purely because I don't have a computer in when I do a consultation. So at the moment we are still on paper. So I don't actually use my computer a lot during a consultation. If I'm in same day emergency care, I don't have access normally at the bedside, so I've just a pen and paper. But I will sometimes go out end the consultation and then go and search 100%. And I do it, and I will say to the patient, I've looked this up, or I will show them pictures. So sometimes if I've seen a rash and I've said it looks like this, I'll take them to the computer I've been looking at and show them it. And I'll show them the x-rays and things like that. But I do certainly use up-to-date BMJ best practice on a daily basis.
I also find the computer is useful for showing patients a blood result or an X-ray that I think they might find interesting. Maybe it's because if I were that patient, that's what I'd find interesting. But of course, I come at it from being medical myself. But I noticed that patients often like to look at results on computer screens. Some patients have been around the block a few times with a long-term medical condition and might ask questions like, what's my creatinine today, by the way? Or what's my CRP? Because last time it was this. And I find that quite a good reference point. But the way our SDEC set up is we're both sitting side by side looking at the screen. So I can't sort of look, they're not on the other side of this of the computer. So whatever I type, they see. And I can't remember, it's been so long time since I've been to the GP surgery, if that's what GPs have now, whether they can see screens at the same time. But I think that patients are accepting of medics showing them up-to-date data. I think they might not be so accepting of google.com.
No, I completely agree. I certainly often say to patients, would you like to see your x-ray? And they're like, yeah, that'd be really interesting, actually. And I will take them to the screen or, wherever, if I'm on a ward round or whatever, I will try and, I guess, involve the patient in their journey through the hospital instead of sort of us telling them what we found. I'll describing it to them, I'll draw it, or I will show them the picture. And they'll actually find that really helpful and really useful.
And maybe I'm pointing them towards a useful resource. I see so many people with headaches, migraines in SDEC, and the migraintrust.org website is absolutely fantastic. And I do love steering patients towards that and showing them what it looks like because so many useful tips and information for patients how to manage a migraine, for example. So I use it for that as well.
Yeah, and another good one is when I have a patient who's got new atrial fibrillation and I might be starting them on a DOAC, I will always give them, if they haven't got access to the internet, I will print out information off patient.co.uk or I will direct them to the website. Because I find that really helpful as well, rather than trying to describe it in a couple of minutes and they forget it. It's always good to give them that information.
So, shall I tell you a bit more about this patient? What I was thinking of at the time, foot drop, yes, common peroneal nerve palsy, exactly like you said, but I've also think that there is a myotomal cause for that. If you have a radiculopathy, and I looked at my little dermatome map, my myotome map, L4 is responsible for dorsiflexion. So I thought, is this an L4 nerve root issue or nerve issue? The nerve root irritation, a radiculopathy, to me, that's usually associated with a bad back. So they got bad back pain and then it shoots down in a nerve root pattern. And in my experience, they very rarely get an actual motor loss. They tend to get pain in the nerve root pattern, sometimes altered sensation. But it's very unusual that then a nerve root is so irritated, for example, by a bulging disc, that they actually lose power. So I thought that steered me away from that and steered me more towards a peripheral nerve problem, i.e., common peroneal nerve palsy, fibular nerve palsy, same thing. So I took a bit more history from the patient. Just so you know, her social history was not very exciting. She works in finance now, and she drinks 30 units of alcohol a week. She does not smoke or take any other drugs. On examination, her vital signs are all within normal limits, and she had a noticeable foot drop. So on examination of a full lower limb examination, the left leg was completely normal. The right leg had normal power at the knee. It had normal plantar flexion power. Flexion is the only nerve root I remember because it's S1. I distinctly remember medical school. They said, imagine the patients can't stand on their tootsies. And if you spell tootsie as TOOTSIES, that SI is an S1. Do you spell tootsie, but you put S1 in the word? That's the only one I really remember. If anyone is listening to the podcast who has English as a second language, tootsies is a very silly, childish name for your toes. So they can't stand on their tootsies. So, she had so normal plantar flexion. Dorsiflexion was impaired. She had about 3 out of 5 motion trying to dorsiflex the foot, and that explained her foot drop symptoms. Her reflexes at the knee and at the ankle were preserved, and her plantar went down. And then on sensory examination, she had a patch of altered sensation completely doing the down the left the outside the lateral aspect of the calf. So from the knee went all the way down to the ankle, and then it went over the dorsum of her foot down to the big toe. And I spent quite a bit of time poking her in the leg to get those sort of boundaries. Yeah, that was the full examination. At this point, I was thinking, so either she's got an L4 nerve root problem or a common peroneal problem, but I didn't think it was the nerve root because she had no back pain. And the pattern of sensory loss didn't quite fit L4. It didn't quite make sense. I know that S1 sensory is the lateral calf, not L4. So why would she have S1 involvement as well? And L5 is the plantar aspect of is the, and the upper lateral calf. I just couldn't make it fit. We had lesions at sort of L4 and 5 and S1. And you know, people with really bad spinal problems do have multiple levels of nerve root problems, but it was much nicer to call it a peroneal nerve palsy. It wrapped it up a bit nicer. Now, whose dictum is it that the single most likely diagnosis is the right one? It's Occam's, right?
Occam's razor, we've got Hickam's dictum is a patient can have as many diseases as their dental pleases.
But Occam said the single most likely diagnosis is probably the correct one. So that was what I was following at the time. Sorry, you were going to ask me a question.
I'm just thinking a little bit about this is going to sound bonkers. So I always remember at medical school being taught fibular head abnormalities, boots, ski boots, don't ask why. So often you'd see a lot of people with head of the fibula fractures because they'd be wearing ski boots and they fell funny on their ski boots and they broke their fibula head and the peroneal nerve wraps around that fibula head. So she clearly, well, I don't think she'd been wearing ski boots on a night out. However, had she been out the night before and wore really, really tight boots?
That's actually a really, really good question. You kind of preempted what I was going to talk about a bit further along, but
Okay.
you had not. But
Okay.
what I said to her was, show me how you sit. Sat down and she crossed her legs and she rested
Yes.
perfectly the right fibula head against the bony part of her left knee. How often do you sit like that? She went, oh, all the time. This is how I just sit. It's comfortable for me. And I said, I think you've got a compressive neuropathy of the common peroneal nerve because you're sitting cross-legged and you're physically pressing on there, just as you said, as it wraps around that fibula head on the lateral aspect, and you can feel it now. If you feel the lateral aspect of your knee, you can feel that fibula head. That's exactly where you're coming from, the vulnerable, the compression. And I said to her, I think that's what this is. I think this will settle down if you stop doing that over a couple of weeks. And we had a bit of a chat about compressive common peroneal nerve neuropathies. And the big things, exactly as you said, is knee-high boots. So anything that's going to compress at that area. So plaster casts, people who have to wear a cast for a broken ankle is really common as well. And when you're getting a plaster cast fitted, you've got to be really careful that it does not terminate exactly at the level of the fibula head, because it's just nerve on bone there, right underneath the skin surface. It has to terminate a little bit lower than that. And the interesting thing about common peroneal nerve palsy, it's the most common external pressure neuropathy you can get. I always assume carpal tunnel syndrome would be the most common, but actually common peroneal nerve is. And it's commonly caused by compression due to leg crossing or anything that's going to compress the area. It's also really common with trauma. So if someone has fallen over and banged their knee and now they've got a foot drop, that's very neat little diagnosis you can make before you even x-ray the knee. I think you've got a fibular head fracture and it's caused swelling and pain, and it's impacted upon your common peroneal nerve. And a simple knee x-ray will confirm your diagnosis there. And the thing about common peroneal nerve palsies is the ankle jerk is usually intact, as it was in this case. You only really use your ankle jerk if you've got a severe sciatic nerve lesion. And it recovers conservatively in weeks if you just remove the trigger, is what I advised her. The common peroneal nerve is made up of L4 to S2. And the sensory aspect on the leg is exactly how she described it to me, that lateral calf, dorsum, right, going down to the big toe. And it dorsiflexes the foot. It also everts the foot. It also extends your big toe. So lifts your big toe off the floor. So I tried to be clever, but she had not progressed to that level where she could not elevate, she could not extend her big toe. That's another thing I guess you could look out for if you really wanted to clinch your diagnosis of a peripheral nerve lesion, common peroneal nerve. Just to do due diligence, I also did a mononeuropathy screen. I was in ESTEC and had access to it. Someone comes in with a mononeuropathy, then I usually have a little set bloods that I do, which is looking for covert diabetes, so an HbA1c, autoantibodies, just in case there's an undiagnosed vasculitis, and an ESR. And that all came back in due course as negative. And when I rang her in 4 weeks, it had completely resolved, which was great, because when she came in, she sort of wanted an MRI scan, and she was referred to me as ED, as probably needs MRI to rule out quadriquina. And sometimes that can be a little bit difficult to step back from once a patient has been mentally prepared for a certain outcome. But I was able to do it because we were able to discuss looking at the computer together the common signs of a common peroneal nerve palsy. And I said, oh, look, here, let's just go to this website. Here it is. Oh, my goodness, look, tick, tick, tick. You're a textbook case. You fulfill every single criteria. And she was really reassured by that. It was nice to see that on the screen in black and white, to know that I wasn't not doing an MRI because I didn't, you know. I wasn't very good at top of a doctor, and to assuage her concerns in that area.
So at the beginning of the podcast, you mentioned she was really worried about this being melanoma because she'd had it when she was 18. At any point during the consultation, did you think that it could be? Because she mentioned earlier on, you know, had she got lesions at L4 and S1 within the spinal cord, at any point did you think this could be melanoma?
So I when she divulged this to me, and I said, so tell me where was your melanoma? It was, I think it was over 10 years ago, and it was on her shoulder. She showed me the excision scar. There was absolutely no recurrence. And I said, have you noticed any other skin moles anywhere that look odd? She went, no, I'm fastidious about this. I get my moles checked all the time. I've not noticed anything. In my brain, this could be wrong, melanoma tends to go to liver. But I guess anything can go to the spine, I suppose. But total absence of any signs of a recurrence of a skin malignancy was very reassuring.
Okay. I know it goes to the brain as well, doesn't it? Melanoma and the lungs as well. So it can be very aggressive, can't it, when it has metastasized, it can be pretty grim. Okay. You mentioned the bloods that you did. You looked for mononeuritis multiplex that you can see in your vasculitides, B12 folate, diabetes. What about nerve conduction studies and EMG, electromyography? At any point, did you consider doing those tests?
I would love to have them. We don't have access to those tests, or rather,
Okay.
we do, but on an outpatient basis over many months. So my
Okay.
plan was, if it hadn't settled down, then I was going to pursue that. But I wasn't too concerned. I think that because I was quite convinced in my mind that if I requested nerve conduction studies and I managed to get them same day, the results would say there is general slowing in keeping with a compressive neuropathy. I was quite satisfied with my diagnosis, and I guess that's about where your confidence lies in your clinical, because when you have access to tests, it's quite tempting to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And sometimes we think that's safe, but it's safer because you get absolutely every test possible. But I don't think it really is. Even if you take away the resource issue, the finance issue of doing too many tests, even if you say, oh, it's a non-invasive, non-toxic test, I think if you order tests which you aren't 100% sure are needed, you tend to get results that you aren't 100% sure you know what to do with.
And there's a lot of thought, isn't there, about investigations that if you do a test, you should really understand the sensitivity of the test and the specificity of the test well before you do it, because otherwise you're going to be doing lots and lots of tests that actually you don't really understand what they're looking for. And if it is positive, well, what does that actually tell you anyway? Particularly, I've noticed that around, I'm going to mention it, D-dimers. I can't mention do a podcast without mentioning D-dimers, but also some of the rheumatological tests like ANCA. Often I've asked, have you done an ANCA? I'm like, well, I'm in ESTEC, so actually I'm not really sure that doing an anti-neutrophil cytoplasmic antibody in ESTEC is appropriate, because number one, it's going to take quite a long time to come back, and it's not going to be me probably who's following the patient up. And is it relevant? It's so I do. I think the I'd like to, I'm going to say older, but I'd like to think wiser. The wiser I get, before I do a test now, I question it a lot more than I would have done probably 10 years ago. I am a lot less test heavy. In fact, sometimes I do no tests at all. And I take a history, I listen to the patients, hopefully they'll be able to tell me what's going on, and I do an examination. I can get the diagnosis that way. And often I will then do a confirmatory test. So I might need to do a CT scan of the abdomen to confirm the bowel obstruction. I may need to do an ESR to confirm the polymyalgia rheumatica. But actually, the history has given me the diagnosis, and I'm understanding why I'm doing those tests instead of just doing a barrage of tests before I see a patient. However, there is one caveat to this, and I was in a very, very busy ESTEC shift last week. It's quite overwhelming, actually. And the wait was quite significant, as it is for lots of people now in the NHS. And often I'll say, don't do any tests until I've seen the patient. However, if that patient is waiting 4 to 5 hours to see me, maybe longer, by the time they've seen me, then I say, oh, we need to do this. They can be waiting 7 or 8 hours, and that's not fair. So, should we front load patients? Tests at the front door in ESTEC. We've briefly touched on this before, haven't we? Should every patient come to ESTEC have a full blood count, use an EES and LFTs? I don't know.
You're exactly right. It's a time issue because, look, if I'm going to be honest with
It
you,
really is.
I'm going to moan if I have to see a patient and I've already got all these investigations I didn't even want. But I'm also going to moan if I see a patient and they haven't had any tests done and they've got to wait another 2 hours for the blood results. So you can't win them when I'm around.
No.
I'm a human being. So I think, yeah, you've got to decide. I think there are basic tests like FBC and U's and E's. I don't really have a strong feeling about them being done sort of preemptively as a screen. But yes, when you get into D-dimer territory, or when you get into imaging, even like chest X-rays, and yeah, very much CT scans and things like that, I really ought to think they should be done with a purpose behind them. Oh, that's not everybody's style. I know people who every admission who comes in to the medical take gets a blanket set of tests. everyone gets, let's just do thyroid function, let's just do their B12 and folate and a vitamin D level. And it's like, but oh, what, you think they've got thyroid dysfunction, do you? No, but they're here and we're bleeding them, so let's just do this. And that's not my way of doing it, I will say, because if I don't have a clinical for suspicion for disease, I'm not in the business of doing a sort of a well man or a well woman check on someone who's acutely unwell and have to be admitted to hospital and start looking at numbers that I can correct. That's not a very satisfying way of working for me.
And I think the wiser I get, I am much more aware of different styles of how we work. And I've developed a style now, and you've got your style, and everybody's got their own style, and it's really difficult to say you have to follow my style because we all develop our own style. And I know that some people don't like the way I work, and some people do, and that's okay. And it's really hard to try and I think initially, when I was earlier on in my career, I found it, well, my way's the right way, but actually my way isn't the right way. My way is my way, and that's okay. And that's how I'm comfortable working, and that's how I feel safe. But other people have their own safe ways as well. And by the time we've got to...
Because it's the right way for you.
Exactly.
It won't work for everybody else, but I wholeheartedly agree with that. And at least in medical education, I've always said that the role modeling paradigm is one of the most powerful ed medical educations we have. And it takes place very quietly. Sometimes it takes place subconsciously, but it's basically people looking, watching, observing senior doctors and thinking, I like that, I'm going to, or I do not like that, I'm not going to. That's why I always say, I say to consultants, I say to registrars, my teacher, I just say, be careful, because you are being watched all the time, and the what you present to doctors such as foundation doctors or other doctors in specialty training programs is you're presenting someone to be analyzed. And someone whose habits are either going to be picked up or rejected. But either way, just think about what you are presenting. So sometimes I bite my tongue at work because I want to say something, I want to react a certain way. And I think, no, that's not what I want people to see right now, because they're still formulating what kind of doctor they are. They're still on, professional, we're all on a professional development journey, but they're still trying to work out what kind of consultant they want to be. I think they deserve to be exposed to good consultants, so they get a good range of options. But hey, at least in the way we work now, you get exposed to a lot of different consultants and a lot of different styles. And then you can magpie the bits that you like, or you can ignore the bits you don't.
And I certainly see in my practice, I am the sum of different parts of consultants I've worked with over the years. I've got a few consultants who I looked up to now. I idolize them. Some are retired, some are not. And I definitely have taken a lot of how they work into my practice. And I've also seen some, like you say, some practice or some behaviors, some styles that I didn't like. And I've then actively not done that. But some of the people, that's what they like. And that's who we are. We all bring our own personalities to work, don't we? And I think that's really, really important. We were talking about investigations, and I'm not a big investigation person. Anybody at work will know that about me. But what I have really like is consultant triage in ESTEC, because I find that if we have enough staff on and I can see the patient at the front door, and they'll bring them in, one of the nurse will do the observations, and I'll have a very brief chat, and I'll be like, actually, I can do the bloods, I can print off the blood form, they need an ECG, and actually they need a chest X-ray, so they can go away, have those tests, and I'll see them in an hour's time with those tests when I finish my triage bit. And I find that really helpful. And actually, sometimes I can actually then discharge at the front door. Actually, this doesn't need to be seen even in ESTEC. This can be seen by the pharmacist, or
Can you do that
say that
all the
again
time?
better.
Do you do that, or do you have the bandwidth to do that every day or not?
No, absolutely not. No, and it's something that we aspire to do. And I think in an ideal ESTEC, it would be wonderful to have that. Staffing precludes that sometimes, and sometimes the number of patients that we have to see, if you're hitting 40, 50, very difficult to do that. But in the morning when you may have six or seven waiting, that consultant-led triage can be incredibly effective and really get that turnover working and much better for that patient journey when it works, definitely.
I absolutely agree. This is something we've discussed in meetings where we try and say that any learning we can get from how we staff our department during industrial action. For example, of course, we're understaffed because of a lot of our colleagues are on strike, but we notice that on these days, sometimes flow improves, sometimes weight goes down. And when you try and track down why, it's usually because of what you're saying. We posted a consultant at time zero rather than at time, 9 hours later. And it makes me wonder if we got the whole take back the front with this whole post take coming at the end. I wonder if it needs to be completely turned on its head. But and what can we learn? Can we do that normally? Oh no, we can't because of staffing issues. There aren't enough consultants. But I think it would be great if there was a consultant way where at the take and in ESTEC, there was a consultant first approach, just to triage, sort, make some initial plans, and the eyeball, whatever the eyeball is, eyeballing patients, and then work letting the team work. If you, as long as you bear in mind that there is a large group of doctors who are training to be that consultant, and how are you going to teach them to do that role rather than take a lot of the work and decision making away from them, disempower them? But if you manage to embed that into a department, especially in unscheduled care where we both work, we've seen a few times now, isn't evidence, the actual data, that it does improve things a little bit. It's a shame that we can't run that service 24/7.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a massive difference when we do have consultants in triage in ESTEC. And hopefully that will be something that we can aspire to do in the future, is to really deliver that, that service that you could see, that perfect service. But as we all know, we have difficulties in the NHS, and that is something we aspire to do. And even if you get to do 1 or 2 hours per shift, that can really be helpful. So maybe it's something we could be trying potentially. But like you say, if we are going to be doing that triage, could we use it as an educational opportunity and get our trainees, one of our trainees in with us to see what's going on in our heads when we are making those rapid, quick decisions about what tests to do, what tests not to do? Absolutely.
Encourage them to say why. Encourage
Yes.
them to say why you didn't do this or you did do this, and telling them rather than saying, hey, watch me. Because
Yes. Yeah.
not brighter than doctors who are still in training. We're just using a experience that
Absolutely. Yeah.
we've got to make some rapid fire decisions, and we don't always get it right, but that's great for them to see as well.
Oh, absolutely. And I probably get things wrong than I get right. It feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? And sometimes I do things at work that I'm not proud of, or that I've made mistakes. But and I've been on shift with doctors who've seen that, they've thanked me for it, because that's life, that's human nature, that's the pressure of being that on-call consultant and working those long hours, is recognizing when you've made those mistakes, reflecting on them, and moving forward, isn't it? And
Agreed.
that's a key thing. Okay, so let's reflect on this then. So you brought to me a case of this individual with foot drop, which turned out to be a common peroneal nerve palsy. I never knew that common peroneal nerve palsy was more common than carpal tunnel syndrome. So that is my learning point for today. So the problem now is I've got that bias in my head. So I'm going to see about however many people tomorrow I'm going to diagnose them with common peroneal nerve
Your
palsy.
dermatomes and your myotomes up on the screen, it makes it a lot easier.
Absolutely.
And also,
Yeah.
I didn't mention was how we do Tinnell's test. Do you remember Tinnell's tap test?
Yes. And Phelan's test.
Yeah, you could do Tinnell's test for on the fibula head. So just where that nerve is, you can tap 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 tap. The patient will go, oh yeah, oh the tingling is worse, the numbness is worse, the pain is worse. So that's another nice little bedside trick that you can use as well.
Great. So again, it all goes back to taking that history, doesn't it? You asked her about how she sat, how she crossed her legs, and you saw noticed that she had compression of that common peroneal nerve around that fibula head, and she got better just by
Doing
not
nothing.
crossing. By do yeah, but also you didn't do any investigations. You mentioned some blood tests, and you didn't need to. And she sat there, and you made that decision between yourselves, you and the patient. It was a very shared decision-making process going on, and I think that was key to that consultation.
Yeah, me too.
So, one thing you want us all to take away then, Ben.
I would say it's okay to look up complexity. And if someone has a foot drop, either it's a nerve root problem or it's a common peroneal nerve problem. So have a think about what favors nerve root problem, that's a pathology at the spine, and what favors a common peroneal nerve problem, that's a pathology at the knee. And once you've got those two anatomical areas fixed in your brain, actually it becomes a bit clearer which one you're dealing with, I think.
Great. Thank you so much. Ben, as ever, you're a font of knowledge, and I manage to learn something new every time I listen. Massive thank you to everybody out there who's listening and for all of the incredible feedback that we get. It's so nice to get your messages and your emails. It really is fantastic. So please rate and review the podcast, and we look forward to seeing you soon. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Right.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.